Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'll be talking about the family, the family's need for balance, and how the family's need for balance influences who we think we are and what we think we can do in the world. I'll also be playing the first half of an interview I did with Pam Wiley, who was discovered at 6 years old and many, many, many years later is still performing. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
The Lynn Show. Today I'm continuing to talk about our families and how the lessons that we learned as children have an impact on not only what we do now, but what we think about who we are. How the lessons that we learned about who we had to be or who we actually were can be inaccurate. But believing them causes us to act out of them. And so we are, pretty much all of us, cheating ourselves from qualities that we actually have, but which we discovered, decided, learned when we were children that we should not demonstrate. So I'm going to talk about that, and I'm also going to play half of an interview with Pam Wiley, who, as you will hear, supported her children and herself for 11 years on one commercial. But this is a jam-packed show, so I'm going to get right to talking about families. Families are not random or haphazard or accidental collections of individuals. In fact, they're made up of very carefully and delicately balanced alliances. The term we use for that is homeostatic. It's a term that psychology took from physics. Webster describes it as an equilibrium produced by a balance of functions, like checks and balances, like what's supposed to exist in the federal government, balancing the executive, the judicial, and the legislature. Doesn't always work so well there, but boy, it works very well within families. If you look carefully at your own family, you may be able to see how it's balanced. For example, think about the descriptions of your family members. Are the men loud or shy or hardworking? Are the women dependable, responsible, or frivolous? The parents may be hippies and the children yuppies, or vice versa. The entire family may be very careful and cautious, and then maybe one kid who's a daredevil. Whatever the division is, there will probably be some kind of balance, and if you look carefully, you'll be able to see it and also to begin to see where you are in that series of balances. Families are so carefully balanced that if any member changes, say a hippie gets a job or the yuppie goes on welfare, the balance of the entire family shifts and everyone is suddenly in danger of losing their equilibrium. So once you've accepted a role, the balance of your family depends on your maintaining it. Consequently, if the change you want to make means giving up your assigned role in the family, your family's dependence on you to play that role may very well affect your ability to make that change. The unconscious unwillingness to upset family balance is often a major obstacle to change. The qualities that exist within families are like intelligence agency operations. Some of them are overt, some of them are covert. Some of them are out there in the open, and some of them are hidden. So that means that while you are demonstrating some quality, you're acting as though something were true. Its opposite may also be true of you, but you're unaware of it and pretending that it's not so. For example, let's say that you think of yourself and you act as though you are the soul of generosity. That is, you're always thinking about what's good for the other person and not what's good for you. It's entirely possible, I'm sorry to tell you, that you have the capacity to be what you would probably call selfish. That is, to think of what you need and ignore the needs of others. But you've hidden this ability, not only from others, but from yourself as well. You probably believe, as most of us do, that you are just the way you are, and that your family members are also just the way they are. You may believe that both you and your family members are the roles that you've been playing all along. But it's not true. It's much more likely that each of you has been denying aspects of yourself for the sake of the family balance. Not only you, but all of your family members are capable of being very different people. But your natural reluctance to unbalance the rest of the family stops each one of you from changing. Does one of your family members have a quality that you wish you also had? If you do, you may believe that you'd have to struggle to achieve it, or even that it's impossible for you to achieve. But it is possible for you to achieve this quality, and in fact, it may already be a part of your makeup. But in order to protect yourself and your family's balance, you have been denying it. Ask yourself how different your life would be if you suddenly had this denied quality. What would be the effect of this change on your family's balance? Suppose you were no longer timid, but were suddenly very outspoken. What if you were no longer irresponsible, but suddenly dependable? How would the members of your family act toward you if you were no longer poor, but suddenly had a lot of money? Since these are qualities you'd like to change about yourself, your first answers are probably going to be the upside. You'd be happy, employed, loved, rich. Your family would be pleased, relieved, delighted, surprised. Well, after you've examined all the benefits of this change, look for the downside, the danger or unpleasant side effects that might accompany the switch. What new and scary things might be expected of you? Who would be surprised or shocked or astonished? Who would be scared or angry, disappointed or jealous? Who would be threatened, left holding the bag, or out of a job? We rarely ask ourselves these kinds of questions, and for very good reason. It's upsetting to think that a change that would enhance our life could upset our whole family's balance. We much prefer to think of ourselves as free agents, unattached and unencumbered by the needs and expectations of our loved ones. But that isn't the truth. We all learned very young, very early, what our families wanted and or needed from us, or in some cases, just who they thought we were. If you got a lot of colds when you were an infant, you might have gotten labeled as the sick one. If you were shy, you know, at the beginning, you might have been labeled as the antisocial one. This would be because somebody in the family wanted to be the one who took care, the saving one, the fixing one, the loving one, or somebody else wanted to be the outspoken life of the party one. Or, simply, somebody else had been assigned that quality already and so it was taken. This may not be a concept that you are familiar with. It may take some time to get used to the idea that who you've been defining yourself as all of your life is only a part of the truth. Next week, I'm going to give you an exercise to help you figure out what the particular roles in your family were and maybe get an opportunity to see where you fit in that system. And in future shows, I will be explaining the roles of cover story and undercover. That is, the qualities that you demonstrate being your cover story, just like a spy, and the ones that are true for you but which got hidden as your undercover. But if you don't want to wait for future shows to hear about this stuff, all of this information exists in my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And if you're interested in the book, or the workbook that goes with it, or the audiobook if you prefer to listen, all of those things are available, as are the podcasts for most of my shows, and information on me. All actually you would ever want to know about me. You can get that stuff on my website, thelynnshow.com. That's LYNNE. Don't leave out the E. SHOW, thelynnshow.com. So, okay, if you're interested in this whole aspect of family and family balance, please come back next week when I will continue to talk about this and also do an exercise that will help you figure out where you are in your system. Talk more about balance and unbalancing within families and how that impacts what you think you can do in this life, hopefully opening up more possibilities to you. And now I'm going to play my first half of my interview with Pam Wiley, who is just a delight. This is a woman who life took over. She, as I said in the opening, was discovered at six, unbeknownst to herself, and has followed the path that was laid down for her, mostly with joy and delight, and as is true for all artists in our culture, sometimes with struggle. But she has maintained her adorable sense of humor, her optimism, and her immense charm. And I'm sure that you're going to enjoy and probably learn something from Pam Wiley. Here she is. Here I am in my kitchen with Pam Wiley, who got here even though I gave her bad directions. She managed to overcome my dyslexia, which I am. Oh. I'm horribly, screamingly dyslexic, and I make these mistakes all the time.
Oh, that's all right. I'm very persistent.
Yes.
I never give up.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
That's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I'm going to want to hear more about that.
Okay. So, and actually, my guess is I will, because I do these interviews. They're titled Anatomy of an Artist.
Oh, okay.
And what I am curious about, interested in pursuing, is how you became it. I'm interviewing people who made their life or their living with their art.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly that is true of you.
That's true.
I know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm really curious about how it happened, how you found it, or it found you, or do you understand what I
mean? Yes, I do. Actually, I guess it was more or less fate, because it happened when I was very young, so I had really nothing to do with it except I existed. And I had an aunt who... whose daughters, my cousins, mm-hmm. were both exceptionally gorgeous young women, and they were pretty big-time models. Mm-hmm. So my aunt invited my mom and me to come to a shoot, and then we'd go out to lunch and whatever else we were going to do. I was six.
Oh, and hold on, that's my telephone, and I can't figure out how to stop it, so we'll stop this for a minute. Okay, so
where were we? Oh, I was six.
You were six.
Yeah. How long ago was that? I'm not telling. Anyway, so we went to this film shoot, and a photographer, very famous photographer at the time, was Avery Slack, and he was doing this job, and he decided he'd take some pictures of me just for the fun of it. Now you have to imagine this little six-year-old with kind of curly blonde hair and pigtails, and cute, I guess. And so he,
clearly.
So he took these pictures. Mm-hmm. Well, he liked what he saw, so he invited me back. And then he took some more formal pictures and sold one of them to Coronet magazine, which you're probably too young to even know about, but it was a small Reader's Digest type magazine.
I do actually.
You do
know
actually?
Yes,
okay.
I do.
And I was the May... month of May girl that year.
Do you still have those?
Oh, yes. I have a treasure chest. I call it my treasure chest. So that happened. And after he sold the picture and everything, he said, I think you should go. I'm going to see that you can meet John Robert Powers. Now, this is, you know, in the 40s. And he's... at that time, he had one office, you know, like...
Oh, he wasn't...
It was just one in New York, just like the... What's L or... I don't even know who's the big, beautiful model agencies anymore, but John Robert Powers used to be that kind of agency. And he had no children in his agency, so I got to be his first child.
Oh, wow.
Model, and then my brother was his first... male child model. He's 3 years younger. He was also cute as a button. So I got bitten, and from there I did.
Well, wait one second now. What was your mother thinking about all this?
Oh well, my mother was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So
she just had beautiful children, and she.
Yeah, she. Well, she was beautiful too, but she was a school teacher, and she taught high school. I have to say, she was not a stage mother. She did not give up her life. And
did she mind, or was she pleased?
She was happy for us.
Yes.
Just very happy for us. But she didn't change anything about her life or our life. When we could go to an audition, or we would go. And if we couldn't go because of her schedule, we didn't go. So there was no push or shove. I got no dancing lessons, singing lessons, acting lessons, nothing.
You're kidding.
No.
So what were the auditions then?
Well, mostly to start with, they were modeling, and all you have to do is
show
send
up.
Your picture. I mean, you know, you're called because
right.
of your pictures.
Right. And then you show up and you bring
show
your body.
Up and you bring your body and they put the clothes on you and or whatever kind of thing it is. I went ice skating for Ovaltine. once I had to do a Band-Aid commercial and cry and, you know, things like that. But over on the other side, I started auditioning for community theater. The first play I did was Guest in the House. I was seven. And I played the child in that play and had a blast and loved it. And it just, very casually evolved from there. I mean, I really got bitten by the bug. I was so at ease, so at home. I loved the whole
thing. It was right for you.
Yes, it was. And there was no... My father wasn't terribly thrilled, I have to say, as I got to be a teenager. Because then I was going by myself into New York, and I lived in New Jersey, I should say that. I lived in New Jersey, and I would go into New York on the bus. At about 15, my mom said, you know, it's time, you can go by yourself. So I started to do probably more work, if I remember correctly. However, I also started to get propositioned by photographers. And
propositioned in what way? In the way that you're suggesting?
That's right, in the proposition way.
Wow. At 15?
At 15. And I also discovered the other side is the bigger the gift you gave to the casting person for a photographer or whatever, the more often you would get called. None of which did I think, I mean, I was not raised to go with that kind of thing. So I said one day to my parents that I really didn't want to do it anymore because it wasn't fun. Mm-hmm. There was
a dark side.
Yeah, and it didn't interest me. On top of which, my parents were getting pressure that I was not in school enough and I should go to the professional school in New York. And, you know, but I also was a soccer player and a cheerleader.
You were a kid.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I was a kid. President, vice president of my class. And
no, you were a real kid.
I was a real kid.
Right.
Yes, and I stayed a real kid because it just, I was happy. I was doing community theater. I was big time actor in my high school, you know, and I got enough attention. I didn't need any.
And, you know, I think that a lot of this is because your parents didn't,
they didn't
co-opt it.
And that's right. They didn't make a big deal of it.
Right.
To me, to anyone else, this is just...
Something she does.
This is what
she
does.
She plays on the soccer team and she models for... Right. And, well, I really think that's so important because when it becomes so important to the parent, then the pressure's on the kid.
Exactly.
Right.
And it when it's not fun, and fun being an all-encompassing word to me, you know, when it's not, it doesn't bring you joy.
Yes.
Then I don't think you should do it. That business.
Right.
If it becomes something that drives you to drink or drugs, I think it's not worth doing.
Well, and especially if you're young.
Yes. Oh, especially.
You know, I mean, if you've chosen a career and you're a grown-up and there are tough times, okay, fine.
Exactly.
But kids only do that sort of thing when it doesn't feel good to please a parent, and that's a bad...
Absolutely.
Right. So, well, lucky you.
Right. So I was lucky. So when I got out of high school, I had chosen Denison University as my college because they at that time had a, and I'm sure they still do, have a fine theater department.
So you did know that you were interested in pursuing
Oh, yes, I wanted to keep going.
Right.
Especially the theater. I mean, by that time, I didn't grow tall enough to be a model, per se, that John Robert Powers would hang on to. At a certain point, you know, I was fine as a teenager, but I was not going to grow to 5'10" or whatever a good height was then. Now it's more like 6 feet. But and I didn't become gorgeous. You know, I mean, that's not what happened to me. I'm sort of a regular, all-American looking girl.
And, you think this isn't gorgeous?
No.
I just want you to know I'm going to try and put a photograph of her on my website and you can all decide for yourself.
Well, anyway, so I that kind of faded, but the acting stayed. Now, in the meantime, before I actually quit, I also got to do live television commercials because this is before, you know, there was television and not before television. There was television, but it was before there was any kind of filming for broadcasting across the country or anything like that.
Right, everything was live.
Right, so two things that I vividly remember doing. One was Jell-O. And in that time, for some odd reason, they didn't want the Jell-O to jiggle too much but between the cup of Jell-O and your
mouth
taking a bite of the Jell-O, which wasn't easy, you know, but... And you do it, you know, you do it live. And there's like a spokesperson over here going, yakety, yakety, yakety.
So you can't tremble or anything.
No, you can't tremble. In fact, you have to be very, very careful.
That's right. And smile.
And enjoy the Jell-O.
Right.
And the other one, which I really enjoyed, was I did a number of yo-yo tricks for Texaco, because they used to give away
yo-yos.
Football yo-yos during football season at the Texaco station. So I, you know, those were my two favorite, or the ones I really remember doing, and I was probably around 14. When I was 12, I had the opportunity to play one of the children in Annie Get Your Gun at the Paper Mill Playhouse in Millburn, New Jersey, which is an Equity big theater. I think it's struggling now, finally, like many theaters are.
So are you saying you got your Equity card at 12?
No, I did not. I got my Equity card in my early 20s. The rule then, and I guess still is, at least you get one free ride before you have to join a union, and then if you are hired into another union production, you had to join, be it the Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, American Federation of Radio and Television Artists, or Equity, Actors Equity. So, no, I didn't. And so I didn't have any, but that was my first real professional job. And I turned 12 when I was doing that show, and they gave me a birthday party on the stage, and the audience sang happy birthday to me. And I'll tell you, you know, there's some things in your life you never forget because they are just treasures. And I will never forget that. I was so surprised. And anybody in the audience who wanted to come up on stage and talk with the actors and have birthday cake and,
wow.
You know, it was really something.
It was perfect.
Yes, it was. So I went to Denison University and I decided I'd be a doctor. But I liked the theater, so I would major in the theater and biology. You know, there's nothing like being type A, whatever, and also having dreams beyond reality.
Well, very diverse interests.
Oh, yeah. Oh, very. And still.
Yeah.
So I started out, and I did fine until rehearsals conflicted with biology labs.
I knew it.
In the evenings. And I have to say, I gave up biology, obviously. I mean, I gave up it as a major. I did finish my course,
yeah.
But, you know, I had to figure out how to do all that. And I stayed with the theater in there. I did a lot of different productions. I did summer stock in Ohio for 3 years. I got married. I eventually had 3 children. I eventually got a divorce because, unfortunately, my husband was unable to function. Talented man, and he's now deceased, but he was an alcoholic.
Yeah.
So I had to leave. I used to feel that I was taking care of 4 children, and one was my age,
right. Yeah.
Because I was providing for everybody and so forth. So
he was also a performer?
He was a director, actually, and a very fine director, and an actor. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And we had an awful lot in common, and I thought we could do wondrous things together, which I think we could have had he not succumbed to what would more or less now more or less be called a family disease.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But he died in, well, maybe 10 years ago now. So he never did accomplish much of anything, and that was very sad. And my children lost him because he never came to see them. And so I did leave. That was in Michigan. While I was in Michigan, I did a lot of commercials. Now we were into the time of commercials. Being filmed, and if they needed a quote actor, they would cast me. And even after I moved to New York, back to New Jersey actually, from Michigan, I would get called back to Chicago, back to Detroit, you know, because there weren't that many actors at the time. And of course, when I did finally move to New York, I got an agent, Don Buchwald, who now, of course, is his own entity, and I know I'm going to misspeak, but it's either Mr. Stern or the other man who's kind of aggressive and abusive on the radio that he manages.
Well,
But he has a huge agency now, both mm-hmm. coasts and everything. And he was just working for somebody when I met him,
wow.
Monty Silver, another agent. And Don and I hit it off like crazy. And he made my commercial life a heaven. I auditioned maybe 10 times a week. I booked a couple times a week. I supported my three children all by myself and in New Jersey in a nice house. And, you know, we had a very reasonable life for most of the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a part-time job.
Right.
So,
and it was something that you could do easily and that you enjoyed.
Right.
And that
I did.
Was, right.
I had to give up my theater because by the time, of course, you get to be all grown up and you get, and I had a wonderful, I had John Davidson's theatrical agent. You know who John
wow.
Davidson
of course.
Is? Yeah, I went to school with John and John set it up for me because, of course, he was a big hit already by the time I moved back to New York because I was in my late 20s then. And he set all this up for me. And but
again,
I had,
again, that's another thing that just got done for you.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, people were very enthusiastic about
you,
me. So, so I had a lot of support. And Bruce Savan was his name. And he was not happy when I said, you know, I can't take dance lessons. I can't take singing lessons. I can't go to acting class and put shoes on my children's feet.
Right.
I just can't. So
there isn't enough of you.
No, there isn't. And you know, you just don't earn, really, to start out, you don't earn enough money to take care of three children on the Broadway stage. You just
right.
don't.
Right. And anyway, then it's a job, and then it's over.
Yes, exactly. So this way, there was a day of work, and
yeah,
lots
there was
of
continuity, and
right.
Yeah,
exactly. No, it was the perfect.
It was the perfect job. Right.
It's different now. They do it differently now. The business was just starting, and they were very gracious and kind to actors. Then they are not nearly so.
No, and there are lots more of you now.
Oh, there are lots. Because when I was doing it, anybody who was a fully trained actor
was not
carrying
that
equity card.
Coming.
No.
Mm-mm. Right.
They, an actor wouldn't do a commercial, you know. And so I got a lot of it of. Opportunity that I think is just not available.
But again, it's the timing.
The timing is
right.
all.
You know, it's just you were in the right place at the right time and it happened for
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's great.
Exactly. So that went on, you know, and I did fine. Then my parents retired to Sarasota
mm-hmm.
in 1977 and I came down to see them in 78, I guess. It must have been 78. I was on a visit to see them, and my parents took me to the Oslo mm-hmm. Theater, mm-hmm. The old Oslo. And I went to see Bob Strain, who was the artistic director then. And we sat down and chatted for a while. He said, you know, I think I'll audition you when I come to New York. Now, I hadn't been on the stage for 11 years, and I thought, oh, well, that's what I want, so... One night, right, the night before I was to audition, because he sent me sides and everything, he was very nice, I said to my children, I said, do not fall down, scrape a knee, get into a fight, don't do anything, and don't knock on my door. I'm not here.
Right.
How old were they? Let's see, that would have been... Well, my boys were born in 61. I have two children born in the same year, January and December.
Oh, my goodness.
They call that Irish twins, and I'm not Irish, but somehow I managed to do that. And then I have a daughter born 4 years later, so 61 to 78, because it was 78. Is oh, my math is wonderful.
Well, I can't do it either, but it's something like 14 and
17. Yeah. No, they weren't quite that old. Well, that's about right. Yeah, you're right. Right. So we had, so I went and I auditioned and I got hired and I came down here. And
for
I
what? Hired for what?
Hired for the Oslo for a season.
Oh, for a season.
For a season.
Not for a particular show, but for a
no,
season.
For the season.
Ooh.
I had a wonderful time here. And I did 6 out of 9 plays. It was more or less a true rep company then. I mean, it still is. It's somewhat, Michael Edwards is running it somewhat the same way, excuse me, once he gets into his season. because occasionally people would come in for specific roles.
Right.
Maybe two roles.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought he was looking for you for, but no.
Mm-hmm. No. So I came in for the whole season, and I did everything from a sort of tipsy maid to the lead in Let's Get a Divorce, which is a French farce, which I did with David Howard, mm-hmm. and Desdemona and Othello.
Oof.
And History of American Film, where you play lots of different characters, including I was the Virgin Mary.
Big range.
So, you know,
Desdemona
all the way
to the Virgin
right.
Mary.
All the way to Chiquita Banana.
Lots of fun. Mm-hmm. Lots of fun stuff. So I had a wonderful time. And, of course, it just made me want to do more, but I'd already committed to going to Los Angeles because my brother, my youngest brother, was there, who's not interested in the theater at all, and he was there for a time for AT&T, and he said, why don't you come and stay with me, because, you know, one of my boys was gone, one was in senior in high school, and my daughter, you know, but I had somebody that could take care of them, and they refused to come with me because, of course, senior year in high school, no teenager's going to leave. So I came for 10 months. I was here 10 months, and my daughter came down a lot. My son would stay with his friends a lot, and it worked fine, mm-hmm. just fine. So I went to, when I got home, I should back up a little bit. When I got home, my daughter, I sold the house because my second son was gone, and I thought, well, I'll move into New York. I'd always wanted to live in New York,
mm-hmm.
always, and I was afraid for my children.
Wow.
And I should never have been afraid for my children. They got into worse trouble in Whippany, New Jersey than they would have probably ever gotten into in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But that's hindsight. So we had an interesting conversation. My daughter said to me, you know, I want to go away to boarding school. Because you're tired of being a mom. Can you imagine?
Yeah, I can.
And she was so right. because it was just a lot of work all
right.
those
and
years.
And you'd been doing it a long time. Right.
Yeah. And she was perfectly happy to go away to school. So she got mostly scholarships through her 4 years at Blair Academy. And by that time, I had decided to stay in California. And I found an apartment. And I found my husband, actually, as it turned out.
Well, L.A. was the right choice for you.
That, for that reason.
Yes.
But getting back to my work, while I was in New York, I made a commercial for Calgon water conditioner. This takes place in a Chinese laundry. I am sure that you probably have seen it. It ran 11 years.
Oh, my
God. And occasionally it still runs on TV land. I mean, it hasn't for a couple years now, but for a while it was running.
So Calgon supported you for a while.
Right. That was like an annuity.
Right.
And helped a lot. But as I became involved in my business in a serious way with children, I had said to myself, if I ever go 12 months without a new booking, mm-hmm. I would stop. Well, in 1984 or 85, that happened, okay? I didn't really book. I did some plays in L.A., but I did not do any commercials. And Calgon stopped running.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. So this is what I did afterwards. I was going to go get a master's in human resource management, and someone persuaded me to be interviewed for a job with a nonprofit management consulting firm. And I started out as a part-time researcher with them. Having no resume, I had to entertain the president of the company because I didn't know what to say.
Right, right.
I just made him laugh, and that was fine with him. He hired me. So I did that, and eventually I became full-time and got accounts. And the last account I had was for the California Vietnam Memorial, which I was the consultant on to raise the money, which was I would go out to airfields and sell hats and cups and what have you, because, you know, that's really the only way any memorial for Vietnam gets built. You don't get those big gifts
oh,
because
God.
It's, you know.
So I did that, and that was my last job. And he sold his company to the biggest one in the country, and they, you know, I didn't want to do that. From there, I managed a theater for a while, a small...
In L.A.?
In L.A., a small semi-professional theater. And then Theater 40, it's called in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I decided if I'm going to work this hard, I better have medical care, because I had run out of my Screen Actors coverage and stuff by that time. And so I went to Showtime Networks, and I mean, I interviewed at Showtime Networks, and I ended up working as directly with the senior vice president of original programming for Showtime Networks for 5 years. And that's when we moved. At that point is when the earthquake came, or when we planned to move, and we were going to rent our place. And the earthquake,
then you didn't have a place to rent.
Plans, so we came. My mom died 10 days after I got here.
Oh, my God.
And I figured, you know, since she probably knew, Dad would be all right. And Dad was aces, you know. He was fine. He still played. He played golf, 18 holes of golf the day before he died.
Wow.
And he was a volunteer for the Literacy Council. And he was about 88 when he died one day, boom, in front of us. And that was interesting. But, you know, he had a great life and he was a great man.
And that's the way to go.
That's the way to go. And he deserved that.
Yes.
Because I used to call him St. Bill. You know, because he was really remarkable. Anyway, so that brought us here with no work. And, of course, I learned that about $6 an hour would be the maximum I'd earn, and I'd say, not at my age. You know, I'm going to do something else. So Lynn and I decided we'd go into real estate together because he was in the car business. And we ended up with Michael Saunders.
In 94. Not bad. 95.
Yeah, 95.
Not bad.
No.
Bad timing yet again.
Yeah, exactly. So we stayed with my father in his condo till, you know, till after he died. And we actually stayed another year till, because I was the executor, and I finished all that. And then we started making some real estate investments. And we worked for 5 years, built a business. And one day my husband came to me and said, that's it, you're out of here. You're going back to what you do the best.
Wow.
And I said, really? Absolutely. So I have two agents, although I haven't heard from one for a while, because I when the gas kept going up, I didn't want to travel all the way to Miami anymore. But I do go to Orlando for commercial auditions, and I've gotten close, but I still haven't booked one here. And what has happened is that I have, through Jeffrey Kinn, who cast me in his play, Anna Leona and the Lady Luck, which is a remarkable play, and ended up playing opposite me because the person who was the leading man was, young man, was taken ill right before it was to open. His play was chosen by the Players, 5 years, could be 5 years now, as their winner from the Plays the Thing series they do every summer. And it got a three performance opportunity the next summer. So he cast me. And we worked on that play, and we brought that play to that, you know, three performances. It was such a hit that the Also group, a gay organization for teenagers and so forth, they in town, they decided they would buy the theater and if we would come back and do the play.
As a fundraiser.
As a fundraiser.
Wow.
They sold the place out. We did it as the hurricane was coming at then August that year. And then we took it. It also had been accepted for the National Gay and Lesbian Theater Festival in Columbus, Ohio. So we left that performance and headed right to Columbus. And we did three performances there and won. His play, Jeffrey's play, won. He won Best Actor. I won Best Actress.
Oh, my God.
Female actor, as they say. And I still want to market it for him. I've done a little bit, but you know, you get busy. So that's where my theater work in this town
took off.
Basically generated from. I had done a couple of other things, but that's where it really took off. We also did it again at the Glenridge Players mm-hmm. a couple years later. We brought it back again. It's such a marvelous piece.
Is it two characters?
No, it's actually five. One, two, three, four. Four characters. It's a mature woman and a young man, and they meet on a bus. And the first act is practically a bus. It's just the bus ride from Ohio to New York. And it's hysterical. And it's sad. And people would say to me, you know, I was laughing so hard one moment, and then the tears are running down my face. And I said, yeah, isn't that interesting? It's a remarkable piece of writing. And I had a couple people, one who was a grandmom of a gay young man, who came to me afterwards and said, and in tears, and said, thank you so much, because now I think I'll be able to understand my grandson and be able to talk to him, because I haven't known what to say to him.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now what am I doing? I'm doing so much I can't see straight.
And it's like you like her. I know it. I know it.
So I should promote the most recent thing.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I just started rehearsals for The Importance of Being Earnest. I am the director.
Yeah, it's my favorite play.
No.
It is my...
Oh, well.
Right.
I'll get you a ticket.
Please do.
Absolutely.
I know the director.
That's right. And I'm enjoying it immensely. So I'm learning more and more about Oscar Wilde, though. I'm so fascinated. I did not know until a friend of mine who did a master's degree thesis on Oscar Wilde that he wrote... fairy tales.
Really?
Yes. And this wonderful gentleman gave me a gift of a book, the book of his fairy tales. And he wrote some of them, I guess, while he was in jail to his children, but he also wrote them before that.
Wow.
He wrote them to his children, or for his children. There is a writer named Giles Bandreth, I think. I'm pretty sure could be Brandreth. I think it's Bandreth. From England, who now has Oscar Wilde starring as the sleuth in a series of mystery stories. And there are four of them, two of which I know you can buy here
I read
in this
one.
Country. Did you?
I did. I read one.
I've read one, and maybe we read the same one.
Maybe we did.
The one I read had the Oscar has an evening with gentlemen that he has once a month or whatever, and they play games. So the game of that particular evening was to write down on a piece of paper and put it in the hat the name of the person that you would most like to see dead.
That's not the one I read.
Okay.
I
will not say
great anymore. Oh,
but,
that
you know,
sounds great.
And 2 days, you know, in the next couple days, two of those
die.
Named die.
Right, yeah, right.
You
right,
have
right.
to find out, you know.
I can't remember. I found this book in a bookstore or the library or something.
Yeah, they have two in the library, and they have two, I believe, at Barnes & Noble. You know, you can buy two. But he's actually written four. I don't know whether
it's
the others
smart.
Are out of print or whatever. And, of course, there are many, you know, biographies, authorized or unauthorized, in the library you can get the trial transcripts of his trial.
Yeah.
And
there was a play here not that long ago that did that.
Yes, at FST.
Right.
A Matter of Indecency.
Yes,
I think
it was wonderful.
Called. Yes, it was.
Mm-hmm.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And in talking to people about Oscar Wilde, they are, well, not even so much talking to people, but in reading about Oscar Wilde and various smart people, you know, and their opinions, it's so interesting because I find his work very entertaining.
So do I.
But so many, I mean, like The Ideal Husband and some of his Salome and all these other plays, basically most of these erudite people say, well, really the only thing that's worth being, you know, considered a good play is the importance of being earnest. But I don't think that's true.
No, I agree, but Ernest is such a good play.
Oh, yes, it is.
Such a good play that it's really hard. I mean, truly, I don't know how many times I've seen it and in how many different,
exactly,
you know, they did that movie.
Yes.
You know. No,
they did a couple of movies.
And well, the last one where they had the dream sequences.
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
You know, but everybody wants to do it.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know.
Right. Well, Jeffrey has decided to put one straight play in his season, which I am not familiar enough with the players to know if that's the first time ever, but, and I probably think it isn't, but it's the first time in a very long time. Mm-hmm. So I have a big responsibility to make it, you know, so entertaining, or at least as entertaining as the musicals are to the audiences of the players.
Because, well, you can hardly have picked a better play to,
well, exactly,
to risk it with.
Exactly. And I have a wonderful cast. My Lady Bracknell is from London, and you know, an equity level, though not equity, but equity level actor, and she will be marvelous. And my young ladies are delightful, and my young men are delightful too. And I'm in this case I'm using one actor to play both butlers.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Because, you know, mm-hmm. the first butler doesn't have really very much to do. And so I thought, you know, well, let's just see how this works, mm-hmm. because hopefully no one will realize it's the same person. We have all kinds of ideas.
Yes, I'm sure. Yes.
And
camouflage.
Exactly. And Miss Prism is a very fine actress and director named Linda McCluggage. And Leslie Dawley is playing Chasuble, and he's been on that stage all year, and he still has another play to do this season. He's just loving it, you know, but he's very good. So, and the directing has come simply from Jeffrey having lots of confidence in me. He asked me to direct a couple of years ago for his Got a Minute plays, mm-hmm. so I directed like 21 of those. Last year I produced and directed Got a Minute.
Yeah, I was there for that one.
And, oh, good.
That was amazing.
Oh,
my God.
Wasn't it fun?
Oh.
It was too much fun.
Yeah.
I know.
I was really blown away by it.
Yeah. It does that. It blows us away, too.
Yeah. And you can see it.
Best time.
I know. You can see it, and that's part of it.
Yeah. I think that's true. Mm-hmm. The joy of everybody.
Yeah, it's spilling off the stage. Right.
Exactly. And then also last year I directed two plays for the Odyssey Theater's 10-minute play festival, which comes in March. And right now they've hired me again to direct three of a production they're doing called 3x3, which is three plays by three authors, 10-minute plays. Let's see, one, two, three, four of them have already been published in Krauss's best 10-minute plays of whatever year. I think 2007 and 2008. And I'm also their artistic director, so I'm supposed to watch over everything and set up the program and things like that, which I'm also working on. That I start rehearsals for as soon as I'm finished, as soon as the importance opens. And then I get a break.
Sure you do. You just don't know what you're doing next. That's all. And now you're right.
I don't know if you could hear that because we were laughing so hard, but I was saying, sure, she's going to take a break. She just doesn't know what she's doing next. But in fact, she does know what she's doing next. And next week, I will play the last part of this interview, and you can hear what she's doing next. I'm also so sorry. Because the players schedule their shows for such a short period of time, you're not going to be able to go and see The Importance of Being Earnest because it's closed by the time you hear this interview. But I got to see it, and as I said, it's maybe my very favorite show in the world, and it was wonderful. And so at this moment, I want to give a plug for the Players Theater. It's community theater in Sarasota, Florida, but the quality of the work is remarkable. And as you can see, they get really prestigious, really well-trained, really successful people to work there, people like Pam Wiley, of whom you can hear more next week. So, again, as I am closing in on the end of this show, I want to thank Josh Hackney, the computer IT electronics recording guru guy who saves my life continually as I struggle to get to learn the learning curve of this new technological experience that I'm calling my radio show. So thank you, Josh Hackney, and again, as always, anybody out there who needs anybody to do any of these things, please go up on my website, thelinshow.com, click on Contact Me, say I need Josh, and I'll find him for you, or say anything else you'd like, and I'll respond. So, as always, again, I hope that you heard something that you can use in this show, something that amused you or interested you or annoyed you, but something that will bring you back, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure.
Tune in again next week when I'll play the last part of my interview with Pam Wiley and continue to talk about family balance and give you an opportunity to figure out what the balance in your family might be.
Into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing. Not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing. Not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got to